Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
With Ring cameras, you can protect your home from anywhere. You're at baggage claim, and you get a motion alert. Check live view and see a guy looking in your car window. Luckily, you've got floodlight cam. So you press the siren button and let 105 decibels do the rest. Problem solved. Home protected. Bag on its way. With Ring, you can protect your home from anywhere. Learn more at ring.com.
You've built a killer sports podcast. You bring the heat every week, and you have a loyal audience. But when it comes to monetizing, you're still leaving too much on the table. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on delivering the play-by-play and hot takes, and our experienced sales team goes to work bringing in ad dollars. Let's turn those downloads into revenue. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and start making money from your podcast.
As we were saying, it's going to be a wet morning, a wet commute. The chance for showers really lasts until around 9, 10 o'clock today. Then it lingers throughout the day, but eventually it goes away. That's because a weak front is coming through. Highs today of 86. Tomorrow, 88, but it's going to be drier with lower humidity. Saturday, 88 for a high. Sunday, 89. Dry heat on Monday and Tuesday. Highs of 90 then all the way through Wednesday, and then sunny through next Saturday. So the rain's going to be here today, and then it's going to disappear. So we're going to have to deal with that and just relax and drive slowly and get where you're going. Well, drive safely, not slowly. Holden Lewis joins us now, Nerd Wallet's home and mortgage expert. Talk about the Fed cut and what that could mean for homeowners. How you doing, Holden?
Hey, Tommy.
You all right?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Hope you're doing well.
I am, sir. Let's talk about what the Fed did and how that could impact people that are looking to buy a house.
Last week, the Fed cut the federal funds rate by a quarter of a percentage point. So that's the overnight rate that banks charge each other. It's kind of like a floor, you know, that a lot of other interest rates rest on. Now, the thing with mortgage rates, though, is that they move quicker than the Fed, you know. I mean, the Fed was sending hints that they were going to cut that rate. And so mortgage rates fell before last week's meeting. And, you know, they've mostly stayed down. So, you know, your typical mortgage, a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, if you have good credit, it's between 6.25% and 6.5%, which is definitely lower than it has been for most of the year.
Mm-hmm. So what does determine what the mortgage rate is going to be or what moves it up or down?
A lot of things, just kind of the general tenor of the economy. We're talking about inflation rate, unemployment, and the mortgage market basically just kind of mixes all those together, but especially long-term inflation. That's kind of the main thing that activates mortgage rates. And so when inflation is high, then mortgage rates are higher. And when inflation is low, mortgage rates are lower. Now, with this Fed rate cut, I think that the market is just kind of waiting to see what exactly happens, because they might decide that it's inflationary. You might see mortgage rates. It's possible that mortgage rates could actually rise even after Fed rate cuts if the market judges those cuts to be unnecessary or too early.
So what I guess I'm trying to figure out is, Let me give you an example. Let's say you got the first International Bank of Holden, and then you got Tommy's Bank and Trust, okay? How do we decide what the interest rate's going to be? Because from the bank side of it, from the lending institution side of it, it would be the same as us making an investment for 30 years and looking at the return we're going to get, and given inflation, do we really want to invest our money in a 4% rate of return when maybe we could get 6% later on? You got to look at it from their side, right?
Okay, I see what you mean. All right, so here's the deal. when most lenders, they don't actually keep that loan. What happens is they sell the loan to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And so they're lending the money. Let's say you borrow $300,000. You know, they give you that loan. And then they sell that loan to, like, Fannie Mae. And so the lender gets that money back immediately, plus some fees and that kind of thing. So the bank does come out ahead. And then that loan, when it's bought by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, they combine it with a whole bunch of other loans. Mm-hmm. And then investors buy those as bonds. So the reason that it's a good investment for investors is that it's guaranteed. They're going to get their money back. And so, the interest rate might not be the best available, but it's also very safe, kind of like a treasury bond. And so, that's the way they handle that. And, you know, typically, kind of on average, people have a mortgage for about 10 years, and then they either sell the house or they refinance. And so that's why investors kind of compare the return they get on mortgages to 10-year treasury yields. They're trying to get a little bit higher than a 10-year treasury.
Let me go back to this Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae thing. Those are federal agencies, right? So the banks sell, get the loan at 4%, make the mortgage at 6%, then they sell it to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. They get paid how much? The entire amount of the loan plus a little bit, or what? How does that profitable for them?
They buy the loan, basically, like, you know, you borrow $300,000 and they buy it for $300,000. Plus a percentage, you know, basically it's some of the interest that they're going to end up charging. I mean, you know, they're basically passing some of that along to the lender as a profit, but then they're also charging a guarantee fee. It's a super complicated arrangement.
So, it's in the weeds, Holden, and that's why I always say that's why we got to go into the weeds sometimes, because if you've ever played golf for money, that's where all of the big money is exchanged, and that's where some of the cheating goes on, right?
That's right. So they also charge a guarantee fee, and that's between like a half a percentage point and a percentage point of the loan. So that's just a fee that basically says, all right, we're collecting this, and if the loan goes bust, then we're going to pay off, you know, ultimately the investors who buy these bonds.
So who's the taxpayers are ultimately subsidizing the banks for making these loans and then holding them and guaranteeing them in exchange for the people buying bonds, and the people buying the bonds know that they can't lose because Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, which is either the taxpayers or the government printing money, is going to bail them out, accurate?
It's not entirely accurate.
Okay, to fix it when we come back, all right? You can straighten me out when we come back. Sometimes I hurt myself, and I don't mean to. 620, talking to Holden Lewis, NerdWallet's home and mortgage expert. I just tried to find out where the money's going and who's doing what, and text me at 504-260-1870. Don't dare text and drive, but we're talking about mortgage rates and home loans, and are you waiting to pull a trigger? Are you waiting to refinance? What is your housing situation right now? Are you renting instead of buying? I'd like to hear from you. Again, no texting and driving. 504-260-1870. 621, traffic now, WWL. 626 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Holden Lewis, NerdWallet's home and mortgage expert. We're talking about the feds, and they cut the rate, but how does that impact the housing market? Then we got on to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and lending institutions selling the mortgages that they make to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. They get paid up front, then the government guarantees the mortgage to bondholders who in turn buy those bonds against those loans, so the bondholders can't lose money, and the mortgage eventually gets repaid. But I was wondering about the role of the taxpayer or the government printing money in all of that. So go ahead, Holden, fix me up. Straighten me out.
Okay, I'll straighten you out here. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they charge these guarantee fees. And you can think of that as kind of a form of insurance. So, you know, they're collecting, like if you borrow $100,000 and your lender sells to Fannie Mae, they're paying Fannie Mae a fee of between $500 and $1,000, you know, as this guarantee fee. And so if the loan ends up going bust, then that money will be used to make the investors whole. And you might say, well, that's only like $500 to $1,000 per $100,000. But, you know, most people, first of all, they don't default on their mortgages.
It's like insurance. It's actuarially based, right? They plan on more people not defaulting than defaulting.
That's right. And then even if you do default, the bank will take the house and they'll sell it. That limits their losses. If there's
wait, the bank or Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac?
Ultimately it would be the investor who actually bought that mortgage-backed security from Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the entity that actually files the paperwork is the mortgage servicer, which is the company that collects your payments. A lot of times, of course, that's just the same company as the lender, but sometimes it's not.
Mm-hmm. So if I have a mortgage with the First Bank of Holden and you sell it to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, where am I sending my checks, or from who is drawing onto my account every month?
The First Bank of Holden will decide that. So the bank might just say, yeah, we're gonna collect that through the life of the loan. Or they might just say, oh, we're going to sell that servicing to like Mr. Cooper or Rocket or someone like that. And then that company will collect it. You know, the borrower.
Well, wait a minute. What happened to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
All they did was they securitized that loan, sold it to investors, and, you know, they're just kind of they're in the background. And, you know, if the loan does go bust and the investor needs to be repaid, then they'll step in and do that. But they're not really active in a loan that's being repaid and, you know, everything's going well.
All right, thank you for your time, but real quick before we run out of time here, what's the right point to pull a trigger? People are texting in about how much of a percentage rate would it be worth if you have 6.5% to refinance? What are you looking for? What's the sweet spot?
Okay, so the question is, if you already have a loan at 6.5%, I would say refinance when rates get down to 5.75%.
Hmm.
So right now you can get a loan between 6.25% and 6.5%. So that means if you have a mortgage of like 7 to 7.25%, it might be time to start looking into refinancing. You can cut that interest rate 0.75 percentage point. It's worth considering at the very least.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Mike Strain as we do every Thursday morning. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 6:44, 16 till 7 Thursday morning here at WWL. Around these parts, around this time, we talk to Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, a beloved veterinarian on the North Shore, Dr. Mike Strain. How you doing, Mike?
Man, I am doing great. We're getting ready for the great Fall Festival Chili Cook-Off in Folsom, Louisiana, Saturday morning.
Yeah, so tell me about it.
I have entered with my brother Chuck and one of our childhood friends, Mark Milliken, on behalf of the International Harvester Antique Tractor Club, Chapter 36, and we will be a cooking chili. So it'll be a little Cajun, a little Creole, a little surprise, and so it's going to be a lot of fun. We'll be hauling some antique tractors out there. There'll be old cars out there and us cooking. So I've got my official job, which is I think I hold the big spoon in the big pot and stir the pot.
You're the stir.
So I'm the stir. I am the official. Well, that sounds about normal for a politician, right?
Yeah, you got to stir it up every now and then a little bit. Tell me about when it comes to chili, what kind of meat do you use? Do you use this coarse? I like chili with coarse cut meat.
It's going to be hand cut. It's going to be some prime, you know, some really good steak, some good, because remember, this is a competition.
Sure.
Hand cut, you got to get the texture just right. You know, you got to get all the ingredients just right, you know, and then, you know, season just right. And of course, it's got to be cooked just right because, you know, you've probably been involved in some of these cook-offs. Look, the competition is intense.
Oh, yeah.
It's really intense. It's a lot of fun, but it's a good community. We'll be at the Moise Park And again, a lot of fun.
Tell me, what time it starts, Mike, and people that want to go and eat some chili. I presume it's one of these deals where you pay them a price and then you eat the chili as much as you want?
Yep. I think so. So it's from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. So we'll start cooking. We'll set up at 7. We'll start cooking at 8. So I would imagine around 10 or 12 is time. Just whenever you want to come through, just come on by and, in the town of Folsom. So, you talk about a real small town. That's a real small town. And come by and see everybody and just have a good time.
Beans or no beans?
No beans.
Yeah.
No beans.
I'm right there with you. I'm not nuts about beans and chili. Let's talk about.
Not too hot.
No,
12 alarm chili.
No.
Maybe about 4 or 5, right? But no 12.
I'll go with a 4 or 5. I like that. Let's talk about the rain that we're getting, Mike, and how severe it had been. Were we in a drought, and is it affecting the farmers?
We were in a drought, and we had started getting, it was getting too dry, and we were getting very concerned about it, and we started having fires. We had a number of fires. We had about 16 to 18 fires in 3 or 4 days. A lot of them concentrated in the Florida parishes and over in southwest Louisiana. Now, we did arrest one arsonist in Oberlin, Louisiana, set 10 fires. But he got caught setting one, and he's in under a $70,000 bond. And I think the big deal you've got to remember is that is a felony. And then restitution. Restitution runs $1,500 to $2,000 per acre. And so at this particular point with about 100 acres burned, restitution is going to be very severe. But everyone, and thank you for everyone that really abides by those burn bans and extra caution. This rain was much needed. It did come a little intense in places. Some places haven't gotten any rain. Here on Strain Farms, we were waiting for it to rain. We've got a fall garden, of mustard and turnip greens to plant. We didn't get any rain on the fields. So it's kind of spotty, but we're probably going to get some more today. But it's very, very welcome, this little bit of rain. You never want to get it too dry. Harvest has been going very well. Record harvest, I think. We're going to see in the state and in the United States a record harvest. And so, that's going to help, with the low commodity prices, the very, very strong harvest we're going to have.
But you don't want a lot of rain when you're harvesting sugarcane.
Oh, no, absolutely not. No. Because you get down in the mud. And because sugarcane, when you harvest it, you have to meet a quota every day. Every farmer meets that quota every day, regardless of the weather. You can't say, I'll wait next week. Now, we've got some just incredible machines that can go through there, but you don't want to tear up the fields. The weather right now, you get just enough rain because a lot of that sugarcane, it's still growing. As you can say, we can literally hear it grow at night.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're in that final bit of growth, and you want a little bit of rain, knocks the dust down. And really, when you go out there, it just feels so good to be in this weather out there with the cane. And we're going to have an absolutely incredible cane crop. Think about it. We haven't had a hurricane. We haven't had anything really to knock that cane down, to push it down. And so it's been a pretty remarkable year. And when you have a little bit of drought, then a little bit of rain, it puts a little stress on the plant. Stress makes sugarcane accumulate sugar. And so that's going on. But everybody's in motion. I've got about 70 to 80% of our soybeans harvested. We've got almost all of our corn harvested. We're working on, that going into that second cutting of rock.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. TNCs apply. In-app only.
With Ring cameras, you can protect your home from anywhere. You're at baggage claim, and you get emotion alert. Check live view and see a guy looking in your car window. Luckily, you've got floodlight cam. So you press the siren button and let 105 decibels do the rest. Problem solved. Home protected. Bag on its way. With Ring, you can protect your home from anywhere. Learn more at ring.com.
You've built a killer sports podcast. You bring the heat every week, and you have a loyal audience. But when it comes to monetizing, you're still leaving too much on the table. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on delivering the play-by-play and hot takes, and our experienced sales team goes to work bringing in ad dollars. Let's turn those downloads into revenue. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and start making money from your podcast.
Ice, and so that's going well, and some cotton's been harvested. The rest of the cotton is, you know, you can see the bolls opening up, and that's going pretty well. You need good weather when you're harvesting, especially corn, beans, and cotton, because the corn and the beans have got to dry out, you know, have a certain amount of dryness before you can harvest it. And the cotton, you don't want to be, you're not going to be out there harvesting when it's wet. You need that, all that lint to be fairly dry. Sugarcane, you get it every day. And it really makes a difference in the profitability for the farmer. The more difficult it is to harvest, the more money it costs. And so it comes right out of the farmer's pocket. But we're going to have an excellent year.
Mike, ready to sound the all clear on hurricane season or not yet?
No, sir. Absolutely not. It's not all clear. We could have a longer hurricane season to keep watching the Gulf. And, you know, you've seen some crazy stuff out there in the Gulf and some big storms that we have dodged. Well, we are in the second half, but this hurricane season could last into October. So everybody needs to be prepared, do all the things that you need to do, and don't let your guard down because it still could happen. We're not out of the woods yet.
Tell me about this cypress furniture. I want to talk about that.
Oh, I tell you, that was incredible. I went to Mr. Eric Cubillon's. That's Live Edge Woodworks. It's a certified Cajun business. And what he does, he gets Sinker Cypress. He has a very large area that is leased, and he goes out and he uses a probe. Now, this cypress isn't underwater. It's down in the mud in the swamp, and he probes it. He knows what he's doing. He walks the swamp with a probe, and he reaches down and he finds these logs. And some of these logs are 60 to 70 feet long.
That's like I saw on TV a while back, right, where these people would go and they'd find the cypress logs submerged. And it's amazing. It goes to the nature of cypress. They can be submerged underwater but yet not rot, right?
That's correct. And they can be under there hundreds of years. And some of these logs, when he finds them and he brings them out, some of these logs, the trees were 600 to 700 years old. Most of them were cut, and what happened is somehow, you know, they got bogged down in the mud or they left them. Because remember, back in the time when they were cut, they were probably using ox teams, you know, oxen to drag them out of that swamp. And some of them, I guess they just couldn't get them all the way, or they buried in the mud or something. The weather came up or it flooded, and so now he's finding these. And I can tell you, he really knows. He was telling me some of his secrets, which I can't repeat how he does it, but he knows how to find them. He drags them out, and then he cuts them into about 20-foot sections or 30-foot sections, and then he mills them. He has a mill right on the spot, and he makes magnificent furniture. I mean, just absolutely magnificent furniture. You know, he's got planers and everything, and he brings it back to life. And when you look at the grain on these, when you look at these and realize that you're looking at a 2 or 3 foot slab, 2 to 3 foot now wide slab, and that tree was 700 to 800 years old when it was cut, maybe 100 years ago. And so it's reclamation, and he's got a nice business there in Brobridge. You know, he's got a nice crew and is having a great time. But he makes some mantelpieces, you know, bars. He makes also tables and that sort of thing. But to see that, and again, local, you know, he's a local Cajun there, Mr. Cuvillon, and it's just incredible. But it's just beautiful to bring something that was, quote, left, you know, in the swamp. It's under the dirt. He finds it, takes it out, and makes beautiful things out of it.
Real quick, Mike, tell me about fall planting and what people should be planting now, or flowers or vegetables or what have you.
Yeah. So right now it's time for the fall garden. You still got some, you know, some time. You can put snap beans in there, pole beans in the ground, beets, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage. You can get that cabbage in the ground. You can also plant cabbage and, of course, cauliflower, celery. You can collards and mustard greens and collard greens. That's what we're fixing to plant on Strain Farms. And so there's a whole host of things you can still get in the ground. But the window is closing. You can also plant garlic, But again, the window is closing. You don't have much more time. So we get into the middle to end of October. You know, you can run spinach all the way to November and turnips, but the window is closing. You get out there and plant in that fall garden.
Mike, have a great weekend. Good luck with the chili cook-off. I hope you all win.
Thank you, sir.
You bet.
I'll eat a big bowl for you.
Do that, please. Mike Strain, Commissioner of the Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, 654, 6 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. 7:14, sun was trying, Tommy Tucker, the sun was trying to peek through the eastern sky just now, but you're going to have bands of showers coming through until around noon, I think, and then maybe the chance for showers dissipates after that in advance of not really a cool front, more of a dry front, going to lower the humidity, highs near 90 into the foreseeable future in the next week, and no chance for showers really after today. Brian Lagarde joins us, our friend, criminologist, and executive director of Project NOLA. NOLA, how you doing, Brian?
I'm doing well, and yourself?
I'm all right. So I saw the story that David Hammer did on WWL-TV, and it piqued my interest about these barricades, or are they, in the French Quarter? Tell me what happened. Tell me the whole story, please.
Well, imagine if you're on the French, in the French Quarter. You're walking Bourbon Street. You're having a good time with your friends. It's late at night. And, you know, you're in a thick crowd, and lo and behold, and last thing you would expect is a car coming towards you. It's something that we see very often. It's where people become trapped behind the barricades. They park their vehicles before Bourbon Street closes, and they're trapped behind, you know, the barricades. Later, they return to the car. They, you know, then they decide, what am I going to do now? And a lot of times they get in the car, drive through a crowd, reach a barricade, push it aside, and then they drive off of Bourbon Street. Sometimes we see just the opposite, where somebody really desperately wants to drive onto Bourbon Street, whether it's to show off their car or whatever it might be, and they move the barricade to the side. They drive onto Bourbon Street through crowds and then drive out the other side. For the most part, it's fairly innocent, but, you know, the scary thing is some of the people are probably driving impaired. It wouldn't take much for somebody to overreact and hit the gas, and next thing you know, they're plowing through, you know, scores of people. But of course, in the back of our minds since January 1st is, you know, there's also the possible threat of terrorism, and, you know, what can be done with an F-150 Ford Lightning. So it's lots of concerns on many different levels, and we just haven't seen anything get done yet to fix the problem.
So this is at the intersection where the terrorist on January 1st turned the truck, correct?
So Bourbon and Canal is what you're referring to.
Yeah.
But the barricades are all along Bourbon Street, everything at the end and beginning of each block. And the problem is they're all very, very easy to move.
So they don't put a dump truck out anymore, Brian? I haven't been. I don't know.
Maybe for large events. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they would park a heavy truck or one NOPD's armored vehicle at Canal and Bourbon. But you can also, of course, enter Bourbon from Iberville and Bienville and a number of any other streets.
So tell me about the barricades. Which ones are we talking about? What would they look like and how would I know them? The police install them how?
So these are the ones, they're fairly new. They've only been around for, you know, since the attack. It's these large metal barriers, and they don't look very movable. But the thing is, they have wheels on the bottom. There's a ratchet where basically the wheels will deploy, and it makes it easier to move. And so the police, every day when Bourbon Street closes, you'll see police officers will go down Bourbon Street, and they very dutifully will go ahead and put the barricades into place. And once the barricade's in place, they'll use this ratchet, and they'll go ahead and lower the barricade onto, you know, where it's flush with the ground. And it makes it more difficult to move, but certainly not impossible, where we're seeing just all it takes is one person to put their back in it even, you know, slightly, and it moves right out of the way. Even better if you have a person with you to help you. It's extraordinarily easy with zero effort if you just go ahead and use your bumper, basically tap it, and then, you know, gently push it, and then they'll move right out of the way. The problem is they're designed to be anchored to the ground. So once they are deployed, there's an anchoring system, and there's no holes in the ground for the police officers to go ahead and anchor the barricades into. So they're extraordinarily easy to move because there's no anchor.
So this is analogous, I'm guessing, to when you got to move a couch on a floor, some a tile floor or wooden floor, where it's heavy to pick up and move. However, you can lean against it and it slides pretty easy. Is that what we're talking about?
Exactly. Okay.
So not only would somebody be able to slide against it and move it, but the truck, if they were hell-bent on doing some kind of damage, they could move it easily with the vehicle and then continue on their way, right?
Exactly. Reach the end of the block, slow down, push the next ones aside, floor it, plow through more people, reach the end of the block, slow down, push through the next section of barricades, and then, you know, so on and so forth. Very easy.
Let me talk about what made you release this video when we come back, because I know you're very protective of the video that you release, and you're a criminologist. There had to be a good reason for this, and to me, it's like security theater. It's the illusion of security, and there really isn't. And again, if this guy doesn't do this on New Year's Day, none of this ever happens, but it's cost a lot of money. It's almost like the back to the death by a thousand cuts thing, where we're spending a lot of money. We haven't had an attack, but is that because of the security measures, or is it because this was just one misguided individual that decided to kill a whole bunch of people on New Year's Day? 720 traffic now, WWL. 726 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Brian Lagarde, criminologist, executive director of Project NOLA, about some video that he released about barriers in the French Quarter that were designed to prevent a vehicular attack, but that can be easily moved aside either with a vehicle or by somebody just leaning against it. And we're talking again about something akin to sliding a piece of furniture across a wooden floor, where it seems heavy and cumbersome to pick up, but if you lean against it, it moves right out of the way. So as we have this conversation about pedestrian mall, about Bourbon Street, about security, I don't know that has anything, many videos that you have, do they show any security barriers that work, that cannot be moved?
Sometimes people reach the barriers in their vehicles and they either don't try to move them or they don't try hard to move them, right, and they leave their vehicle parked in the middle of Bourbon Street until they can get out in the morning. But there's so many more people that we're seeing moving the barricades out of the way and either getting on or off of Bourbon Street.
So just to be clear, we have these archer barriers that they use the cart to put out. That's not what we're talking about here, right?
Oh, no. So it's not the archer barrier, nor is it the barrier that's at the Bourbon and Canal, which is a different type of barrier. It's all the other barriers that they have all along Bourbon Street, the big metal with the bolts on the side of them. They look, yes, one-piece barrier. Those are the ones that are really easy to move. Those are the ones that are supposed to be protecting Bourbon Street, and they're not because there's no anchor system.
And when it comes to a terrorist attack, you know, as a criminologist, and it's no secret, we're not giving anything away here, that, you know, chances are if somebody's going to have an attack, they're going to probe, or they're going to do some, as this terrorist did, do some advanced planning. And if they see somebody moving these barriers right out of the way, they're going to know that's a weak link in the chain. I mean, it's obvious, right?
Very easily so. And that's why it took us some time. Everyone tried working behind the scenes to get this fixed. The NOPD has been complaining about it for months. It just seems that the mayor's office has done nothing. And as a result, now here we are. We're being vocal about it publicly. So we've been trying to get it to be resolved for months. Nothing happened. Here we are.
So the NOPD complained about it to Homeland Security, I'm guessing, in the mayor's office?
They complained to the they sent it up the line. So it's my understanding the mayor's office of Homeland Security, emergency preparedness, the mayor's office. And it seems like it would be a fairly simple thing to drill some holes in the street so that the anchors would have a place to go into. But it just hasn't happened.
Did they buy these, or are they leasing them, or do you know, Brian?
in my understanding that they're leasing them, quite a tidy sum of money as well. So altogether, it's my understanding that they've spent millions of dollars on the vehicle barriers since January 1st. They're leasing these particular barriers, and they'll work great, but they're designed to be anchored, and without those anchors, they're just going to push right out of the way.
Brian, you have just proved me wrong, and here's why. I always say that when you're a kid, you think that somebody, the grown-ups, are watching something, and then you realize that nobody's watching anything. Thankfully, my friend, you are watching something, and now, no, really, and now you've heard me say that before, and now you're trying to bring it to the attention, and I hope you do some good. I hope we did some good. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it. You bet. Brian Lagarde, criminologist, executive director of Project NOLA. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk about the Saints and the Bills with Steve Geller, WWL sports director. Right now it's time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 7:45, quarter till 8. If you watch Thursday Night Football or listen to it tonight, you'll get an answer to this question as the Seahawks take on the Cardinals. Quarter till 8, Steve Geller joins us now on WWL, WWL sports director. How you doing, Steve?
I am doing good, Tommy. How you been?
I'm all right. I know you got a long day. Thanks for getting it started with us here this morning. Tell me what's going on this evening with Sports Talk.
Yeah, well, our Thursdays at the Treasure Chest Casino, our weekend kickoff, going to have Super Bowl champ Scott Shanley phone in, talk to him about this trip to Buffalo coming up, also preview the LSU versus Ole Miss matchup, and even get the ESPN Bills reporter Elena Getzenberg to come on, giving us the lowdown on Buffalo as the Saints get ready, man, oh, man, for definitely the toughest game of the season. When the schedule came out, I was worried about this one.
I think for all of those reasons, the Saints will play them pretty close because it makes no sense for them to do that. I know that that logic seems contrary, but what do you think?
I get it. No, I get where you're coming from there. I thought, though, that last game, the outcome against Seattle was going to be more of like we were going to see this week, not what was going to happen in Seattle. This Buffalo Bills squad is definitely a juggernaut, a Super Bowl, a favorite to win the Super Bowl. Offense, defense, and special teams are a pretty complete squad. Hoping that the Saints can at least keep this one close. We've seen the point spread, 16.5 point underdogs going into this matchup. That's the biggest the Black and Gold have been in underdogs since 1975. I was the year I was born, so that's a whole long time ago when Archie was that quarterback.
I think, look, I'm not telling anybody how to bet. I like that 16.5, and I think
hard not to, right?
Yeah, well, like last Sunday, it seemed like a lot of points until it wasn't. But I think that I think the Bills might look past the Saints. I think the Saints might surprise them. Maybe I'm wrong, but I hope I'm not. Let's talk about Drew Brees and his eligibility for the Hall of Fame before we get back to the Saints and the Bills, because that's a big deal.
Yeah, and to me, I mean, this is a no doubter, slam dunk. Drew is a first ballot Hall of Famer. And with that, I would imagine that the Saints are going to have that extra preseason game going into next year, because I think they'll play in the Hall of Fame game to represent, you know, one of the teams with a person going in. And, I mean, I'd love to see Jari Evans join him. I was talking to the Cajun Cannon about that yesterday. Jari was first.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
With Ring cameras, you can protect your home from anywhere. You're at baggage claim and you get emotion alert. Check live view and see a guy looking in your car window. Luckily, you've got floodlight cam. So you press the siren button and let 105 decibels do the rest. Problem solved, home protected, bag on its way. With Ring, you can protect your home from anywhere. Learn more at ring.com.
You've built a killer sports podcast. You bring the heat every week, and you have a loyal audience. But when it comes to monetizing, you're still leaving too much on the table. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on delivering the play-by-play and hot takes, and our experienced sales team goes to work bringing in ad dollars. Let's turn those downloads into revenue. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and start making money from your podcast.
Time eligible last season, didn't get in, but he still will be have that opportunity this year. So Evans blocking his way into the Hall of Fame for Breeze just seems fitting to me.
And Leroy Glover also in there, did some time in the Saints uniform.
Oh, yeah. Leroy, man, you look at his numbers and how I didn't realize how long he lasted in the NFL. I think it was a 13-year career. And after his first two seasons, the guy never missed a game in the NFL. When I first moved down to Louisiana, I just remember him being on billboard signs for advertisements and was surprised to see him go, but that's how the way free agency is.
So when it comes to Kellen Moore and discipline and the team, you know, we talked about it, I think, Monday with Mike Dettillier, and I saw some other people talking about it. About Kellen Moore and his style, he's a pretty laid-back kind of guy, right? But maybe sometimes that's not necessarily the way to motivate everybody?
Yeah, that's one of those situations that, you know, everyone has their impressions of what Kellen Moore is like with his team. But to be a fly on the wall in those meeting rooms to see exactly how he's addressing things, I'm curious how the conversations went after last game, not just with the team, also with a guy like Brian Brzee for that headbutt that extended a drive and for Seattle. And to me, that's when everything just started to fall apart, from the Seattle offense being able to stay on the field. After that, we saw a blocked punt, the punt return, and it just all went downhill from that moment. You've got to be smarter. You're not just having a stupid penalty that's going to be against you. That just hurts the whole team and causes that trickle-down effect of nonsense that ended up occurring. I don't know what Coach Moore is like behind those closed doors. He seems this happy-go-lucky, smiley guy in front of us, but I think he's just so well-trained at dealing with the media. His dad, we know, the high school coach. Mm-hmm. He's been a top-notch college football player, then in the NFL as a player, then as the NFL as an assistant coach, and now as the head coach. So he's been there, done that, and knows not to give us any kind of nugget that we can run with.
I think I got a couple of things here. First of all, you don't motivate everybody the same, right? And secondly, when it comes to some people, you motivate with a cheater pipe, right? A foot-long piece of galvanized pipe. Other people, just a bad word can do it. I know a long time ago, I was when I was attending the University of Life, I had to fuss at a mechanic for comebacks at Firestone, and I thought the guy was going to take a swing at me, and he ran out crying. So you never know how people are going to react, right? So you don't put ourselves in a position of judging how Kellen Moore can deal with the team. And sometimes people that are soft-spoken, when they save it so that when they do raise their voice, everybody listens. So let's just hang on a second. It's only been three games. Let's relax. I do think you were right, and I heard you say that on the point after with Bobby Hebert, that it seemed as though the whole thing went south after the Brian Brzee dumb A play. It does seem to go from there.
Yeah, it was unfortunate. The unfortunate series of events started right there for me, and like you know, the game were what, 6 to 8 minutes in, and you just felt like, oh, my God, this thing's over already. Yeah. Hopefully that's not the case in Buffalo this Sunday.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Steve Geller, our sports director, 751, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. All righty, 757 now, back with Steve Geller, WWL sports director. Saints taking on the Bills this weekend in Buffalo. Bills are undefeated, the odds-on favorite for the most part to win the AFC Championship and win the Super Bowl, so the Saints are going to have their challenges for them. The challenges are there, rather. Steve, have you been to Buffalo as a sideline reporter or not?
No, I was just talking about this with our current sideline reporter, Jeff Nowak. That was a trip I did not get to make. We didn't have any road trips to Buffalo when I was my tenure doing that. And I told him, make sure you find the prime wing spot and go check it out for me.
Because we know how good the Buffalo Bills are on offense and defense. I'm wondering about the crowd factor, because they're playing a noon game, and that doesn't happen often there, right?
No, that's a great point, Tommy. The Bills Mafia, as they're called, definitely a rowdy bunch, blue-collar kind of, you know, fan base that loves to get into games, a rowdy bunch, but they're not used to those noon starts, so hopefully they're not as revved up as typically, but I would imagine that the way that this Bills team has been rolling right now, they're going to be pretty fired up there. The good news is, at least we don't have to deal with snow this time of year for sure.
And it's going to be perfect, around 70 degrees and lows at 50 at night. So predictions, what do you think?
I'm thinking along your lines where it's not going to be this total massacre, that 16.5 point spread. I'd be more inclined to take the Saints getting to the 16.5. I don't know. I'm not high on the Saints getting the W in this one, but I do think they keep it like a 9-10 point game. It's not going to be this. And I say blowout, a 10-point game is a double-digit, you know, loss is significant, but I don't think it's going to be 20, 30 points like we saw last week.
Thank you, Steve. We'll be listening this evening. Y'all go out and join Steve Geller, Mike Dettelier, Treasure Chest Casino today, every Thursday. Hang out from 4 till 7 there on the Kenner's Lake Town on the banks of Lake Pontchartrain. We'll come back, talk to Dr. B about falls in fall. WWO. Well, it is officially fall, 8:14 now on this September 25th. September 25th, yeah, that's right. But it's not the time to fall. More than one in four adults fall each year. Luckily, research shows that our fall risk isn't entirely outside of our control. In honor of National Falls Prevention Awareness Month, Dr. B, Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer at People's Health, joins us to share tips for staying steady on your feet and not tipping over. How you doing, Dr. B?
Hey, Tommy, I'm doing great. How about you?
I am well, sir. Thank you. Tell me why fall prevention is so important.
Yeah, this is really critical because it affects so many people. And what it is really is, as we age, your chance of falling down is more likely. And so what happens when you get older, you can lose a little bit of bone density and some muscle mass, especially in your core muscles, and that can make it easier for you to either fall down or, if you do fall, to break a bone. And the other thing is, as we get older, our eyesight and our hearing can decrease. Our reflexes may be a little less sharp than they were when we were younger. So you might have trouble avoiding obstacles or pivoting when you're walking, and so falls can be more likely from that. And then the falls, as you get older, themselves become more dangerous. You know, like I mentioned, the bone density decreases. So if you fall, you're more likely to actually break something or have a more serious injury that may make you have difficulty staying independent.
Anything else that can kind of increase your risk of falls?
Yeah, the other thing to keep in mind is medications can actually increase your risk as well. And these medications are important to treat a lot of those chronic diseases, but a lot of them affect maybe your brain or your blood pressure or your blood sugar as intended, but they can have side effects, things like some tiredness or dizziness or even confusion. And so you have to be real careful with those medicines, and if you're having those side effects, talk to your doctor. You know, the other thing is, certain health conditions people develop as they get older can cause problems. Things like foot injuries, balance problems, that weakness I was talking about, especially in the lower extremities, can increase your risk for falls. And then something really common is called neuropathy. Neuropathy is a problem we see in a lot of diabetics, where it affects the nerves in the legs and the feet. It may make your feet feel numb, so you don't know exactly where you're placing them, and you may misstep and then fall down.
Best thing, of course, to prevent a fall. What are some ways to prevent the risk of falling or lower it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things you can do. Kind of the first thing to start with is make sure you're taking care of your health overall. You want to make sure you're seeing your primary care doctor. You want to work with them to create an exercise routine, because exercise is really critical to reducing falls and reducing your risk of a severe injury from a fall. They can help you, you know, learn exercises to help strengthen your muscles, maybe improve your balance. You know, things like water workouts, walking, Tai Chi are great options. But even something simple you can do in your home, like standing on one leg or walking heel to toe, can help improve that balance, which is so critical. And then you know, in general, just stay up to date on all your medical care. It's really important to manage all your health conditions, including things like vision, because glaucoma in particular, or cataracts, can cause vision problems that can lead to falls. And then, of course, type 2 diabetes, which can cause neuropathy and low blood sugar. That's another one that's a high risk.
You know, as you talk about doing those things, Doc, standing on one leg, et cetera, I think people need to realize you're not doing it to get in shape, and you can't look at it as, well, what kind of shape am I going to get in standing on one leg? The idea is to keep your legs, to keep your balance, to make sure that you can still walk without falling, right?
Exactly. You're not going to bulk up or anything from that, but actually kind of training your body to know how to adjust and make sure you stay balanced is really a critical skill you can lose as you get older.
And for people that don't think there are benefits from that, there certainly are benefits to that. What else can you do?
Yeah, so another thing is if you feel like you need, or your doctor says you need, a cane or a walker, use it. Don't feel bad about it. It's really critical, because that may be the piece of equipment that keeps you from falling down. And then a lot of people, as we get older, we tend to feel colder, so people may wear socks, especially as the weather gets cooler. Be very careful with socks on hardwood floors. They do make some with little grippers on the bottom that can help you, you know, lower your risk of falling. And then avoid really baggy clothing, baggy shirts and pants, because they can actually get tangled up, or they can get caught on something and result in a fall. And then another really big one is, if you have pets, you know, be very careful about how they may affect your fall risk. Cats and dogs can get up under your feet. They can bump into you. So you've got to make sure that they don't jump on you, that they're not walking in front of you, and certainly that they don't pull on the leash, which can be difficult. That can actually pull you down.
I had a dog one time, I swear, was trying to cut me at the knees, cut block me at the knees, or try to walk on my slippers as I was walking on them. So you do have to be careful about that. We'll talk about fall-proofing your home when we come back. We're talking with Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer at People's Health, about fall prevention and how important it can be to make sure that you take care of your overall health. 820 traffic now, WWL. All right, 8:26 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our guest, Dr. Brent Wallace, Dr. B, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. We're talking about fall prevention. It's Falls Prevention Awareness Month, now that we are into fall. Can you fall-proof your home, Doc?
Yeah, you definitely can make some adjustments, and you really should think about doing this, because more than half of all the falls actually happen in the home. Mm. So, I mean, there's some easy things you can do. Try to keep your floors clutter-free. Because you're more likely to trip over something if it's laying in the middle of the floor. And, you know, make sure you don't have any loose cables running all over the place. You might trip on that. And then rugs are really important. You need to make sure, if they're on a hardwood floor, that they've got skid-proof backing so that they don't slip and then you fall down. And then watch the edges of them. They tend to curl up, and that can create a hazard as well. And then the other thing a lot of people don't think about, but lighting is really critical. You need to make sure that your home is really well lit, because you don't want to run into something you didn't intend to. So change those light bulbs, especially around stairways, because that's a really dangerous spot in your house.
And turn them on as it starts to get darker earlier. What else can we do to stay safer on stairs, Doc?
Yeah, so stairs are one of the most dangerous places, and, you know, because you're going up and down, you must have handrails, and you need to make sure they're sturdy, because if you do become unstable, you want to be able to grab onto something. And if you've got wooden stairs, you probably want to think about adding a runner or little carpet squares, because that'll help a little bit with the slipperiness. And don't carry things up and down the stairs if you can avoid it, especially heavy or large items, because they're going to block your vision and you're more likely to fall that way.
How can we make kitchens safer?
Yeah, kitchens, a couple of things you can do is make sure the common stuff you use, dishware and ingredients and stuff, are well within reach. You don't want to have to go up high in a cabinet. You know, you don't want to get on a step stool. You want to use a grabber tool, or just keep it somewhere where it's easier to reach. And then be really careful in the kitchen, because we use a lot of soap and cooking oils and water. And if that gets on the floors, it can make them slippery. You want to make sure you clean those up right away, because that's an area where you could slip and fall.
Speaking of soap and slippery, got to talk about the bathroom.
Yeah, the bathroom is the most common place for falls. And obviously it's because it does have those wet, slippery surfaces. And so you want to do things like add a non-slip mat into your shower area or your tub area. That's going to help a little bit. You may want to actually install grab bars in the shower so you can get in and out easily. Or if you've got a lot of lower extremity weakness, you can also get a shower chair, and that's something so you're not standing up in the bathroom. But be very careful, especially at night, if people get up and go to the bathroom. It's going to be dark. You might actually have an accident.
If you do fall, what should you do?
Yeah, really, falls are definitely going to happen. So the most important thing is make sure you get whatever medical care you need after you have a fall. And it's really important after that urgent care is obtained, you want to make sure you talk to your primary care provider, because they can help you try to figure out either why you fell or what you can do to prevent that fall. But they'll also check you for injuries you don't realize you might have. So it's really critical to have that follow-up appointment as well.
Any final advice, Doc?
Yeah, the only thing I would say is a lot of people fall and then they stop doing what they like to do. And that's actually the worst thing you could do. You want to try to stay active. If you become inactive, you're more likely to exacerbate the problem with that muscle weakness. Don't be scared. It's okay to be a little bit worried, but try to stay active, maintain your strength and agility and everything, and that's going to keep you on your feet.
Again, you're not training for the Olympics. You're just trying to maintain your strength, agility, and balance. Valuable information. Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks, Tommy. Talk to you soon.
You bet. Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. You can find out more about People's Health if you visit the People's Health Medicare Center. That's in Metairie, 3017 Vets. It's located between North Causeway and Trader Joe's. Appointments are recommended, but walk-ins are welcome. You can also go to the website, peopleshealth.com, or call 1-800-978-9765. And I think that open enrollment period is approaching. So peopleshealth.com, everything you need to know right now. Time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9. The password is Thalweg. Thalweg, T-H-A-L-W-E-G. Clint Wilson joins us now, professor of civil and environmental engineering at LSU and director of the LSU Center for River Studies, to tell us what that is. How you doing, professor?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. Thanks for having me.
How about that? The password, Thalweg. How about,
yes,
now, I bet
exactly.
A lot of people, I learned a new word. I didn't know what that was.
Well, every day we got to learn something.
We do. Exactly right. And that's what everybody should learn today. Use this word. Well, I don't know if you can use it 10 times to make it your own, but tell us what a thalweg is.
The thalweg is the deepest part of the river channel. So, you know, it's the kind of connecting the points at each cross section or kind of river mile. Think about where the deepest part is, and then you just connect that as you go up river, down river. So it really gives you an idea of where the deepest part of the river is. And it doesn't stay in the middle of the river, right? It'll move inside, it'll move outside, you know, depending on the currents, the bends in the river, the flow rates, et cetera.
So when we talk about this saltwater wedge, what is it, and at what point does it overtake the thalweg, or does it overtake the flow of the Mississippi River? Is it about a cubic feet per second? Is it about the depth of the water? Take me through all of this, Professor.
Yeah, well, it's actually a combination of all of those, and I don't want, you know, I'll try to explain it here. Is, you know, the Gulf of Mexico, the saltwater, Gulf of America, the saltwater denser than the water coming down the Mississippi River. And so that saltwater wants to, you know, dive underneath or to the bottom of the Mississippi River, wants to do that. Number two, the bottom, the deepest parts of the Mississippi River don't go above sea level until you get to Natchez. And so what's happening is you've got this kind of competing forces of the water flow, the water coming down the Mississippi River, and then the salt water trying to move up at the bottom of the Mississippi River. So they're basically kind of competing or meeting, okay? And when the river's normally in its normal flows, average or medium or high flow rates, the flow, the power of the river is more than enough to keep that salt water in the Gulf. However, when the river gets low, the salt water can move up the bottom, the deepest parts of the river, and it just starts moving its way up the river and potentially then, you know, having the impacts that I'm sure we're going to talk about here in a minute.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm confused about is, tell me again about the sea level in Natchez.
Yeah, so the bottom, the deepest part of the river, the thalweg of the river, it doesn't get above sea level, doesn't get above you know, whatever you want, 1.3 feet, depending on what datum you're using. It doesn't get above the level of the Gulf of Mexico until you get to Natchez. So if you were here if you're in New Orleans or Baton Rouge and you went out into the river and went down to the bottom, you know, you would be below the level of the Gulf of Mexico. So you can think about all that water in the Gulf of Mexico pushing against the
river.
But
that seems counterintuitive to me. You would think the farther north you were, the higher the elevation, but that's not the case.
Well, the ground elevation is the elevation of the levees, the elevation of the community,
but not the
Thou
Weg.
But the Thou Weg is deeper.
I got you.
Yes.
All right. So after that, the river, the bottom becomes higher, right?
Right.
The
yeah.
river bottom, and then I would think that means that the flow could be less after that if the bottom is higher, because then there would be less room for the salt water to go underneath. Stop me before I hurt myself, Professor.
No, that's fine. No, so you know the saltwater wedge, you know, doesn't move past. I mean, I don't know if it's ever moved past New Orleans. Okay, so the power of the river, the velocities, the you know, the movement of that water, of the fresh water coming down, keeps the salt wedge away. So it's the river would basically have to stop flowing for the saltwater wedge to get up to Baton Rouge or Natchez, okay? So really what's happening is in that lowermost part of the river, when you're getting down, you know, below St. Bernard and Plaquemines, that's really where you have the saltwater wedge or the saltwater and the freshwater really are interacting a lot more.
Does this happen anywhere else in the world or anywhere else in the country?
Oh, yeah, it happens, yes. I mean, you could just about any coastal river, you know,
that
any
drains,
river that's emptying into a coast, that drains into
the ocean.
An ocean or
yeah.
a sea is going to have this issue. Yep.
Okay, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back, because it seems like this is the new normal, and it seems like we're dealing with it a lot more now. I didn't even know what it was, saltwater wedge, yeah. and not to mention a Thou Weg, but now I know what it is. 850 yeah. more. If you got any questions about saltwater wedge, text them in to 504-260-1870, and I'll pass them along without hurting myself or you in the process as we talk to Professor Clint Wilson, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at LSU, director of the LSU Center for River Studies. 851, 9 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:56 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Clint Wilson, professor of civil and environmental engineering at LSU, director of the LSU Center for River Studies, about the saltwater wedge and some of the texts that are coming in. Professor, I invite the audience in, so I'll ask some of the questions. What effect the larger draft shifts will have when Port of New Orleans opens? Any effect on any of that at all?
Well, on the salt, if you're asking about the effects on the saltwater wedge, mm-hmm. You know, I don't think we know that at this point, but, you know, the Corps of Engineers is now authorized and they get the funding to maintain a deeper draft, a deeper depth in the navigation channel in the lower river. So, you know, the river is deeper in some locations than it was 10 years ago. So, you know, there is that opportunity for more, I guess, potentially for more for salt water to move up the river.
So deeper means...
Yeah, we don't have enough data, really, at this point to know for sure.
But generally speaking, deeper is saltwater's friend?
That's right,
okay.
Because the saltwater wants to go into the deeper part of the river, right?
And somebody said if you empty the Mississippi River, the saltwater from the Gulf would partially fill the river up to Natchez, from my understanding. Are they right there?
That's right. That's exactly right, because the bottom of the, you know, the Thou Weg, the deepest parts of the river would, you know, don't go above the Gulf of America until you get to Natchez. So if the river was shut off somehow, right, then that the Gulf waters would move upriver.
So how likely is this to happen every year from now on, or is this a new event, or is it just a cyclical thing?
Well, it, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I would have said it happens about every 10 years,
mm-hmm.
okay, but... In the last, since 2022, it's happened every year. And, you know, we also go through cycles of Bonnecarry spillway openings on the other end of the hydrologic spectrum, right? When, you know, we open the Bonnecarry spillway when there's significant floodwaters mm-hmm. coming down. And, you know, for a period of time in the 2010s and early 2020s, we were opening the Bonnecarry spillway regularly, and one year it was twice. So... But we haven't seen the Bonnecarry open in a couple of years. But now we're seeing the low flow. The other end of the extreme, right, is the low flows coming up at this period of time. So, you know, really thinking about what it's going to be in the next 5 years or 10 years is hard. But I do think as a nation and as a state, we need to be planning and thinking about what the impacts are from these extreme, you know, these extremes, low flows or high flows.
You would never have a spillway opening and a saltwater wedge in the same year, right?
No, not at, well. Oh, yeah, you could. That's right, because they occur at different times of the year.
That's true.
Right? The spillways open in the late winter, springtime, maybe early summer, but the saltwater wedge is typically in the low flows, which is late winter, late summers, early falls.
And it all depends on the rainfall upriver, correct?
100%. All of this is driven by what's happening in the Ohio Basin, the Upper Mississippi Basin, the Missouri Basin. All of those watersheds are contributing. And it's really the Ohio River right now, the Ohio River Basin, that the area there that's really in drought conditions right now. And so,
thank you, Professor. Appreciate it. 9:09 on this Thursday morning, and you're about to enter the fastest hour on radio with John Alzheimer, our guest, who is a credit expert who can answer any questions that you have about credit ratings. I shouldn't say that. Credit scores, credit ratings would apply if you're selling bonds. Am I right about that, John Alzheimer?
You are correct. Thank you for having me, Tommy.
Thanks for taking the time. How you been? Credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. You know where the skeletons are buried? Where the landmines lie?
Where all the bodies are buried, yes, sir.
So let's start with some basics for people that have not, well, first off, for people that have not listened before, let me invite them in. 504-260-1870. Oakwood Jeweler Talk and Text Line. No texting and driving ever, please. But a lot of times people listen and then they got questions and then they start texting in their questions and we run out of time before we get to them. Let's talk about what a credit score is and how important it is when it comes to determining how much you pay for credit.
Yeah, I mean, I can't overstate how important a credit score is. So a credit score is a three-digit numeric summary of the information on your credit report. So hopefully your listeners pull their credit reports from time to time, and if they're, you know, older like me, then they're dozens of pages long with a bunch of information about your prior relationships with lenders and such. And you know, rather than fingering through all of that stuff as a lender, which can take forever, you know, about 30 some odd years ago, a company called Fair Isaac, my former employer, invented credit scoring, which is essentially an algorithm that reads all that information off of a credit report and then will essentially create this three-digit number that predicts the likelihood of whether or not you're going to pay your bills on time in the future. And they use all that information on the credit report as the basis for that score. And that score is used, now get this, that score is used billions of times every year. And I said billions with the B.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is used by lenders, it is used by utility companies, it is used by tenant screening companies, mortgage lenders, you name it. So if you can't escape the influence of a credit score, and you really want to have the highest score possible, because that score is used to determine, among other things, the interest, the APRs on money that you borrow. And so, you know, instead of paying 12% on a car loan, having a really good credit score can get you something around 4%. Or back when, you know, you could get 0% offers on certain types of makes and models, those types of offers are for people who had really, really high credit scores. So you always want to have a high credit score. Think of a credit score, Tommy, as like the grade you get on a test. And you want to have the highest grade possible, and based on the answers that you give in the test, that's what your score is going to be. And so that's a really good comparison of a credit score relative to a credit report, the grade relative to the answers you gave on a test.
Well, that leads nicely into my next question, which is, you talk about we should all pull our credit report. Why should we? Because is that analogous to looking at the test that we took?
Yeah, and look, you should pull your credit report for a variety of reasons. Number one, it's a bunch of information about you, how you manage your relationships with your lenders. And wow, I want to see it. I want to see what the credit bureaus are saying about me. And that's the only way that I'm going to know, is by pulling my credit reports from time to time. Doing so is free, so I'm not suggesting that any of your listeners go out and buy credit reports. You can do this for free once a week.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted. So you could pull 52 copies of your credit reports from each credit bureau every single year. That's like over 150 credit reports a year. I don't know anybody who cares about their credit reports that much, but you certainly should do it from time to time. number one, because it's your information. Number two, it's really important information, as we just discussed. Number three, mistakes happen. And you're not going to know if something is incorrect unless you look at the credit report. You're not going to know to raise your hand and say, hey, there's an error here, please correct it, unless you look at your own credit report and go through the information from time to time, make sure the information is accurate. And that's something that we're allowed to do as U.S. consumers, 52 some odd times a year per credit bureau.
And I hate to say this, but I've never done it. So what would I be looking at on a credit report, and how would I know what's wrong, and how would I know if it's worth it to take action if I have checked my credit score and it's almost impeccable?
Yeah, so all the way from Atlanta, I can hear your listeners in NOLA saying, wait a minute, how do I do this? Where do I go to get my credit reports? Where you go to get your credit reports is annualcreditreport.com. That is the single government-mandated website that the credit bureaus had to create 20-some-odd years ago, and that is the single source for free credit reports pursuant to federal law. So that's where you're going to want to go, annualcreditreport.com. Pull all three of your credit reports, Equifax, TransUnion, Experian. You can just download them. You don't need to print them. And then sit there. Grab a cup of coffee or a beer and sit there for the next 5 or 10 minutes and kind of page through all the data. You're going to see all of your loans, all of your credit card accounts, student loans, auto loans, mortgages. If you have collections, unfortunately, that's going to be on there too. If you filed bankruptcy, unfortunately, that's going to be on there too. Go through and make sure that all the information is accurate. Make sure the dates are correct. Make sure the balances are correct. Make sure that the payment history, whether you made a payment or didn't, make sure all that stuff is correct. Make sure your personal information is accurate, name, address, social, date of birth, things like that. Just go through periodically with a fine-tooth comb. Make sure all that info is correct. And if it's correct, lather, rinse, repeat. Do it every few months, and you'll be in good shape. If you notice something that's incorrect, there's information also about how to file a dispute, which you can also do online, which is also free and actually very easy to do.
So what's the perfect credit score?
Yeah, so the range of credit score, most credit scores, there are some outliers, but most credit scores are, the range is 300 to 850. 850 would be a perfect score. You don't need a perfect score. Anything generally above 760 to 780, and you're really putting yourself in what I call the kind of the safe zone, and you're going to get the best deal that pretty much any lender has to offer, mortgages, auto loans, credit cards. You're going to be in good shape.
So I'm pretty close to perfect, having looked at mine on a credit card statement when I paid it a couple of weeks ago. So with that being said, do I really need to pull my credit report? And I'm not asking for me. I'm asking for people that would be in the position that I'm in.
Yeah, so
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
With Ring cameras, you can protect your home from anywhere. You're at baggage claim, and you get emotion alert. Check live view and see a guy looking in your car window. Luckily, you've got floodlight cam. So you press the siren button and let 105 decibels do the rest. Problem solved, home protected, bag on its way. With Ring, you can protect your home from anywhere. Learn more at ring.com.
You've built a killer sports podcast. You bring the heat every week, and you have a loyal audience. But when it comes to monetizing, you're still leaving too much on the table. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on delivering the play-by-play and hot takes, and our experienced sales team goes to work bringing in ad dollars. Let's turn those downloads into revenue. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and start making money from your podcast.
That's actually a really good point. So credit score is a pretty good proxy for the quality of the information on a credit report. It doesn't mean that the information is universally accurate, but if you want to see the underlying data, you always have that option.
So I guess let me phrase it this way, John. If I got a credit score of, say, 842, okay, and I don't know if that's it or not. I don't remember what it was, but it was close to that. Would there be any need to pull a credit report? Because what would I do if I challenge anything? I got a world of hurt waiting for me to get up to 850, which is not going to make a difference anyway, or not?
Yeah, 842.
I'm a lazy guy, John. I'm a lazy guy.
You're in effect. Yeah, you're at 842. That is an elite credit score, using any reasonable definition of the word. I would still, just for sanity, I would still pull the credit report from time to time. Clearly, there is nothing on there that says anything bad about you. So there's no late payments. There's no collections. There's no defaults. There's no judgments. There's no bankrupt. None of that bad stuff is on your credit report if you're sporting an 842. But still, from time to time, it's probably not a bad idea. Look, if my car is running really, really well, I still take it to the mechanic every once in a while just to make sure things are going well. So I wouldn't just ignore the underlying information just simply because my score is good. But an 842 or anything like above 780, you can feel very, very confident that your credit report is saying a whole lot of good things about you.
So speaking of cars, somebody texted in and said, what does my credit score have to do with the way I drive my automobile in reference to insurance rates?
Yeah, so that's another one. So insurance companies, it really doesn't have anything to do with how good of a driver you are. It really has to do with the likelihood of you filing a claim. So obviously insurance companies, you know, the revenue model is you pay your premium, and if you don't file a claim, then you're a profitable customer. If you file a lot of claims that exceed the amount you pay in premium, then you're not a profitable customer, which means they're either going to dump you or they're going to increase your premiums. So the credit score has long been, and it's a different kind of credit score, by the way. It's not the same kind of score that your bank uses or an apartment complex uses. They use what's called an insurance risk score, which also is based on a credit report. So what you end up seeing is you see this three-digit number, and an insurance company may see it. And if it's really, really high, your premiums are going to be more competitive, and they may renew your policy. So no one ever talks about the good stuff that can happen if you've got a really good credit score. Or they only think about the bad things that can happen if you've got a very poor credit score, which could be things like your premiums may go up or they may not renew a policy because you're too risky. It's the same thing if you get in a lot of wrecks. Your insurance premiums are going to go up and your insurance company may dump you.
What is the rationale there? Is it that if you are in financial trouble, you're going to file claims? Or I'm just wondering how they make that connection.
Yeah, so you're thinking like a human, and you really need to think like a computer. So there is no verbal rationale. It's all empirical relationships. And so the insurance industry, despite what you may hear from people screaming about how unfair this is, the insurance industry has been able to prove empirically over and over and over again for decades that there is a relationship between how you manage your credit and whether or not you're going to file insurance claims. That is a statistical fact. Whether you like it or not is irrelevant. That is a fact. Number one, and number two is the Fair Credit Reporting Act makes it perfectly legal for an insurance company to pull a credit report as part of insurance underwriting. So number one, it's perfectly legal because the law says it's legal. Number two, the statistics back up the use of the data for assessing the risk of doing insurance business with a consumer. Now, people then try to rationalize, like, well, what does that mean? Does that mean that I'm worried about my credit card debt, therefore I may get in a wreck? Or does it mean that I may be more likely to file a claim because I'm in financial distress? And people can have all sorts of theories like that, but the real answer is there is a statistical relationship between the quality of your credit and whether or not you're going to file claims. And that's really where it ends, vis-a-vis why the insurance industry uses scores.
And so those actuaries come in. Let's take a break. We'll pick it up. We'll get back. Questions are coming in. 504-260-1870. One of the ones that people always ask concerns credit cards and payments. And this one we'll start with when we come back. Somebody wants to know if you get a better credit score if you run up large balances every month on a credit card and pay it off, or if you run up small balances every month and pay it off. John Alzheimer knows. He'll respond when we come back on WWL. Fastest hour in radio continues, 927. We're talking to John Alzheimer, as we do occasionally, credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. He knows where the bodies are buried. He knows where the landmines are when it comes to credit, and he can help navigate your way through this whole, I don't know, is it a maze or is it a map, John, when it comes to credit scores?
It's a journey.
It's a journey. There you go. I like it. It's a journey. So somebody texted in about running up a big credit card balance and paying it off every month, or a small credit card balance and paying it off every month. Is there any difference as it relates to your credit score or the way people look at you as being credit worthy?
Yeah, so this is one of those really good questions with, unfortunately, it's going to have one of those it depends answers, which I hate, but it is what it is. In the older credit scoring systems, the scoring model only cared about what the balance was on the credit report, meaning that if you run up a really large balance on a credit card and then you wait to get your bill and then you pay it during the grace period, the balance on your statement is what's reported to the credit bureaus. And so the credit scoring model only sees and considers whatever that large balance is. So it doesn't know that you ran it up, paid it off, ran it up, paid it off. It doesn't know that, because that's not what it's programmed to see. Mm-hmm. The newer scoring systems do see whether or not you're running up a balance, paying it off, paying off some of it, paying off all of it, paying off most. So it just depends on the scoring model. I don't like this. Here's a better strategy, if I can make this suggestion to the listener. It sounds like that you have the financial capability of paying off your credit card debt every month, because that the question suggests that. Mm-hmm. So here's what I would suggest that you do. If you don't need that 21-day grace period, then toss it in the garbage, meaning that before you get your statement in the mail, there's what's called a statement close date on it. On your all credit card accounts have a statement closing date, which is the last day. And then they'll take that day and then go in to the prior 30 days, and all of your expenses and payments and credits and charges, that's what makes up your balance every month. I would suggest that if you have the capability of doing so, that you make your payment before the statement is actually cut, which means that the net of your charges and payments and credits is going to equal zero, because you've made your payment before the statement has even been generated, which means that on your credit report, your balance is going to be zero. And obviously, we all know, because we've talked about this for years, Tommy, that really low balances on credit cards is really good for your credit scores. So if you charge up large balances, or if you charge small balances but then pay them off in full every month, just be aware that you're not getting the full benefit of your capacity to do that, because you're allowing the balance to show up on the credit report. So just kind of change your focus a little bit from the due date to the statement closing date, and I promise you, unless you've already got pretty elite level credit scores, it's very, very likely that your score is going to go up simply by changing when you make that payment.
Is that what you've referred to previously as an ethical hack?
That is the ethical credit score hack. You're not doing anything unethical. You're just changing when you make your payment.
So along those lines, again, going back to the previous conversation, and you hinted at this a second ago, which is, but if your credit score is elite, does it really matter?
It doesn't matter. Eventually, you should get into a pattern where if you check your credit scores from time to time and they're really, really good, you've proven to the credit bureaus and the credit scoring systems that you are a good credit risk. And so you don't need to tinker with your behavior, because you're already doing all the right things. So, and you also made a very good point earlier that there is no difference between an 842 and an 850. The lender sees you the same way, which is that you're elite. So you don't need those eight other points. You're not gaining from, but if you try something silly, right? Like, oh, let me do this because I saw it on TikTok, mm-hmm. then you're likely going to end up with mm-hmm. a lower score versus mm-hmm. a higher score. So be happy mm-hmm. with a really good credit score, and just kind of do what you've been doing. Focus on repeating whatever you're doing, and stop worrying about your credit score, because it's already really darn good.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't do anything you see on TikTok, no matter what it relates to anything. I probably wouldn't do it, but I'd probably vet that through a couple of different sources. Somebody wants to know, pardon me, the difference between locking and freezing your credit. Is there a difference?
There is. So if you've ever heard the term security freeze, that is actually something that's federally regulated, meaning that there It Trump 1.0, one of the things that changed during Trump's first administration was the Fair Credit Reporting Act was amended to make security freezes, what we call credit freezes, free. Mm-hmm. There was a time when you actually had to pay to freeze and unfreeze your credit reports. And it was by state. And so, for example, in Georgia, where I live, it was $3 to freeze, $3 to unfreeze. Mm-hmm. Well, now that's all gone, because security freezes are free nationwide. thanks to federal law. And you have the right to freeze your credit report. A security lock is different, meaning that it's not subject to the same requirements under federal law. It essentially does the same thing, Tommy. It prevents unauthorized parties from accessing your credit report until you choose to allow them to access it. But there is some differences in terms of which are regulated under federal law versus which are not. Although, from a practical sense, the lock and the freeze appear to do the same thing, which is to prevent people that you don't want looking at your credit reports from getting access to your credit reports. And by the way, you can do this on an app. This is, you know, people always complain about, oh, this is so complicated. And No, you can do it on an app, meaning that you punch a button, you get your face recognition, and you can slide a little toggle to unfreeze or freeze a credit report or lock or unlock a credit report. So it's actually become very, very easy to do these types of things. And that is actually like the Fort Knox of credit report protection, right? Fraud alerts, credit monitoring, they all tell you, fraud alerts tell you after something bad has happened. It's almost like coming up to someone saying, hey, sir, you just got into an accident. It was like, gee, thanks for telling me what I already know. The security freeze is like putting your credit report in Fort Knox. Mm-hmm. No one can get access to it until you choose to let them have access to it. I love the security freeze.
And how does one freeze their security freeze their credit or whatever we're talking about here? What's
you have to go to you have to go to all three credit bureaus independently: Equifax, Experian, TransUnion. Their websites. You could even Google, you know, how do I freeze my Experian credit report? And there's actually a security freeze page on all the credit bureaus' websites, where you can go and set up your security freeze, essentially take your credit report out of circulation, and no lender with that you don't have a relationship with can get access to it until you choose to call it thawing. So instead of freezing it, you're thawing it. You thaw your credit report, you put it back into circulation, let your lender or prospective lender pull it because you're applying for something. Once you get whatever loan it is you want, then you just refreeze it.
So if you don't, once you freeze it, if you're not applying for any credit other than using a credit card, and that brings me to the next question here that came up via text. Somebody's contemplating a $5,000 purchase. Would it be better if they put it on a credit card for their credit score or paid cash? Does it matter?
Here's what I would do. I would try to maximize your, purchase. And so if you have the financial capability of just stroking a check and paying for whatever it is that you're going to pay for, then that's fine. But here's what I would do if I were in that person's position. I would pick whatever credit card has the rewards program that I like the best. I would pay for it using, unless they want to nail me with like a 3 or 4% upcharge to pay for the credit card fee. If they're going to try to do that, write a check and move on with your life. But if they're not going to nail me for the 3 or 4% credit card swipe fee, I would put it on whatever rewards card I like them at, whatever miles or points with cash back, whatever rewards card is your favorite. Put it on that card. Once the transaction clears, which will take, I don't know, maybe a day or so, go online and then use that $5,000 that you were going to use to write the check, pay off that charge. And then it's never going to show up on a credit report because it's never going to show up on your statement, but you're still going to earn the rewards points for the transaction.
Back to the ethical hack.
Not only is it the ethical hack, but you also get whatever cash back that you would have gotten had you left it on your statement without paying it.
All right, somebody wants to know how many days late does it matter on a credit card payment where it counts against you, or I guess it would get to your credit report, if I'm using the right term?
Yep, so there's two answers to the question. Number one, if your bill is due on the 15th and you pay it on the 16th, you're late, which means they're going to hit you with a late fee, and since you didn't pay off your balance, they're going to hit you with interest. So that doesn't have anything to do with credit reporting. For credit reporting, the reason I'm saying this, Tommy, is I don't want people to think, oh, I've got a 30-day grace period to pay my bill. No, the due date is the due date. Don't screw around with the due date. It's not a suggestion. For credit reporting, however, you get a 30-day grace period.
It's not a suggestion. That's what you're saying?
It's not a suggestion.
That's why they say due date. They don't say it would be nice if you paid by this date. They say pay by this date. Due date. Go ahead.
That is correct. Yeah. That is correct. And for credit reporting, I think that's what your caller or the texter was asking about, you have a 30-day grace period for the first month. So if your bill is due on the 15th, unless you pay it before the 15th of the following month, even though you're still delinquent and you're going to get hit with a late fee, they can't report it to the credit bureaus. You have to be at least 30 days late for anybody. There's no way to report someone 1 to 29 days late to the credit bureaus. It doesn't exist.
But can you do that every month or not? I know you're not encouraging people to do this.
I'm not encouraging people to do this because that's silly.
You get in a hole.
But from a credit reporting perspective, you'll be fine, but you're going to get brutalized with late fees, and eventually the card issuer is going to close your card because you're habitually late month after month after month, even though it's never going to hit your credit report.
Didn't they used to have something? I don't know if it became illegal under Trump 1.0 or not, but I thought there was something where if you were late and late and late, they could demand the entire balance due immediately or not? Am I making that up?
I don't know that they can call full amount due. I know that there's certain scenarios under mortgages that if you default, they can call the amount due. Mm. I'm not sure that that's something. If you default, then you don't have payment terms any longer on your credit card bill. For example, let's say you owed $5,000 on your credit card bill, and you know usually your minimum payment is about 3%, give or take, of the balance. And so in that scenario, you'd be paying about $150 a month as your minimum payment. So those are called your payment terms, okay? And those are the terms that you have. Every month you make that payment, you're accruing interest and whatnot. But if you go into default, meaning that you're not making payments at all and you've gone delinquent, the card's been closed, you don't have those $150 a month terms any longer. You have proven to the card issuer that those won't work, that you're not worthy of those terms. And so they're going to want the full amount. You can still try to settle with them for less than the full amount, but you don't have the ability to say, I promise I'll go back to paying you $150 a month now. No, that ship has sailed. So that may be what you're thinking of.
Let me give you three questions. One, and we'll answer them when we come back. Just ended my chapter 13. What happens next? Somebody else says, I have no debt, pay my credit card off in full every month, have never paid a penny of interest on my card in over 30 years. Put my homeowner's insurance on my card last year, paid it full within a few days of it being posted. My score went down 15 points, took 8 months to rebound. Why? And then somebody else wants to know, why is it that when you pay your mortgage off but still have credit cards, your credit score goes down? John will answer when we come back. The fastest hour in radio, John Ulzheimer, our guest. He's a credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. 260-1870. If you get your question in quick, we might be able to get it answered. 941 traffic now, WWL. Quickly back to John Ulzheimer. I'm Tommy Tucker here on WWL. He's a credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. I hit you with three questions before we went to the break. Which one you want to start with?
How about the one about the insurance premium and the score going down 15 points?
All right, so they paid off. It didn't even get on the statement, I don't think. They put their homeowner's insurance on the card. The credit score went down, took 7 months to recover. Go ahead.
Yeah, so if that, and you actually kind of answered the question for me. If the premium was put on the card, but the balance was paid before the statement was generated, then that insurance payment on the credit card has nothing to do with why the score went down 15 points.
Well, let me read it exactly. He says it before it posted, so I would presume that's before it appeared on the statement, right?
That's how I would read that. That's how I would read that as well, Tommy, because that's usually the term that people use, posting. Mm-hmm. So the score went down for some reason, having nothing to do with making that insurance payment or whatever, paying the premium on the credit card, because it never was posted, never showed up on the credit report. So obviously I don't know what else changed on the credit report, but it had nothing to do with that payment.
So somebody else wants to know about, I just finished chapter 13. What happens next?
Yeah. So number one, congratulations. And that may sound funny, but going through a chapter 13 and quote unquote finishing it takes years. It's not something that happens overnight. And so congratulations for your dedication to paying back some of what you actually owe versus filing for Chapter 7, where your creditors get kind of stiffed. So if Chapter 7 takes many years, your credit score has probably improved considerably since you filed, because that's unless you missed payments in the interim while you were making your payments through your Chapter 13 trustee. It's very, very likely that your score is probably very respectable already, and you're probably already getting credit offers because most of the time, and there's been studies that have proven this, Tommy, that when people file bankruptcy, most people file bankruptcy for some reason other than being deadbeats, a failed business venture, loss of job,
medical,
long-term
right?
illness,
yep.
a bad divorce, which I guess they're all bad. But most people, it's not, people just equate bankruptcy with deadbeat, which is nothing could be further from the truth.
Mine
and
was
so,
pretty bad,
lenders
I'll tell
are
you
not
that,
stupid. Lenders know this, right? Mm-hmm. And so if someone has gone through a Chapter 13, which means they've bent over backwards to pay some of what they owe back, that's actually probably not a bad credit risk. So if you need credit, jump back into the credit market. You may not get the best deals ever, but you're going to definitely get approved. And good luck this time around.
So going back to the person with the insurance on their credit card didn't post, et cetera, they would want to pull their credit report to see what went wrong, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is the importance of pulling the credit report is that you get to see what's on it and what's not on it. And if the payment was made before that charge posted, then and you pay in full every month, then the balance on that credit card should again be zero. If it's something greater than zero, then obviously the payment wasn't processed in time and that charge was posted. And even something minor like a few thousand dollars of a charge, especially on a credit card that's got a lower credit limit, like maybe a $5,000 or a $10,000 credit limit, that could be the answer to the question as to why did my score go down, albeit pretty modest, like 15 points isn't what I would call a catastrophic change in score.
So when it comes to, I'm getting a lot of questions about mortgages and credit scores and paying it off, yet still having credit cards. If you pay your mortgage off, generally speaking, what about that?
Yeah, so I think that was one of the questions before we went to the break. That's actually one of the more maddening aspects of credit scoring systems is that you're actually rewarded for having installment debt. An installment obviously is fixed payment for a fixed period of time, like auto loan, student loan, mortgage, boat loan, motorcycle loan, personal loan. Mm. And credit scoring systems love to see people properly managing installment debts. And if you pay off all of your installment debts or even one of your large installment debts, like a mortgage, then obviously you're not paying that any longer. And it's not uncommon. And even FICO has literature on their website about this because they get this question so often. They've written articles about it on their website that there is a possibility that your score is going to go down after you pay off a large installment debt. Now, look, Tommy, we're not talking about the difference between FICO 750 and FICO 650. Mm-hmm. We're talking, again, a modest decrease in the score, which generally can easily be subsidized by doing something like paying down or paying off one of your credit cards.
Thank you, John. It is the fastest hour in radio. It always goes by too quickly. If somebody wants to get their credit report, how do they do it?
annualcreditreport.com. If you end up on a website where they're asking you for a credit card, you're at the wrong place. This is free. Don't pay a dime for your credit reports any longer.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it as always. Have a good day in Georgia.
You too, sir. Thank you.
All right, John Alzheimer, credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax, 953. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got planned when we come back on WWL.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
With Ring cameras, you can protect your home from anywhere. You're at baggage claim and you get emotion alert. Check live view and see a guy looking in your car window.
Luckily, you've got floodlight cam. So you press the siren button and let 105 decibels do the rest. Problem solved, home protected, bag on its way. With Ring, you can protect your home from anywhere. Learn more at ring.com.
You've built a killer sports podcast. You bring the heat every week, and you have a loyal audience. But when it comes to monetizing, you're still leaving too much on the table. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. we host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on delivering the play-by-play and hot takes, and our experienced sales team goes to work bringing in ad dollars. Let's turn those downloads into revenue. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and start making money from your podcast.